Good job, Cage.
Thanks, Cage said distractedly. Now the main issue will be that we don't have the credentials to gain access through the main entrance to the operation center. The security there will be far more stringent than those slobs working in auxiliary passenger hatch. I couldn't risk falsifying 3 badges because the security codes rotate too quickly.
I assume you have a way around that? Jason asked.
Of course, Cage smiled. It's actually not too difficult, but it won't be comfortable. We can get into the lower levels through an access tunnel.
That doesn't sound bad, Crusher said. Just as long as by access you don't actually mean sewer.
It'll be a little bit worse than a sewer, Cage said. It's where the main power lines that feed the center make entry. There won't be any permanent damage, but the side effects of being near high power lines for the length of the tunnel are unpleasant. Also, we can't take any energy weapons with us, and we'll need to manually power down our neural implants. That includes your ocular implants, Captain.
Well, that's not a big issue for us, but isn't yours a lot more specialized? Jason asked, before covering his mouth to mask his next word. Cass?
It'll boot back up even quicker than yours will, Cage said. Don't worry, I've switched it off manually before, since mine shows up at a distance on most scanners.
There will be no issue for me if the implant is switched off. I will come back as if nothing happened.
We should stash weapons strategically around the place since we'll not likely be coming back out the way we're going in, Cage said. Blades are fine, and the captain's railgun won't be affected, as long as he removes the power pack.
Will do.
The rest of the short ride was spent using whatever imagery they could find over the public nexus of the operations center that would give them a good place to stash their equipment. By the time the vehicle slowed and the holographic display instructed them to disembark, they'd found a place near a side exit where someone had piled a decent collection of hand tools and a rock cutter that used 4 rotating laser emitter heads to cleanly carve channels into the asteroid's nickel-iron surface. The 2 crates they'd brought with them fit right in after Jason had grabbed some black soil from recent landscaping and rubbed it all over their 2 clean surfaces.
The entrance to the power junction is over there. I should be able to slice through that lock without trouble, Cage said. It won't be very secure since the building has redundant power systems. This is just to keep out the vandals and petty thieves.
That, and no sane people would willingly walk through this access tunnel, Crusher said.
That too, Cage agreed, and pulled a device out of his pocket while Jason and Crusher slipped on their lightweight armor and weaponry.
Hold still and I'll shut down your wetware with this. It's easier than trying to enter the proper sequence of the connector in your heads.
Once he'd waved the device over his head, Jason felt like everything became a lot dimmer without his ocular implants smoothing the light out. It wasn't until his friends spoke that he really felt the difference. He couldn't understand what they were saying, since each was speaking their native tongue.
We'll need to practice a bit more for this contingency, he said, in Genovian standard, a language he used so much with the implant's help that he was decently fluent in it.
Except that Crusher's mouth can't properly pronounce all the phonetics for Genovian, Cage said. His teeth get in the way. Come on, the sooner we're in, the sooner I can switch you back on.
The tunnel that ran under 2 streets and into the operations center was nondescript, dark, and had the expected trunk lines anchored to the walls and ceiling. What made it unique, however, was that the radiated energy off the high power lines made them all instantly nauseous, screwed with their balance, and induced near crippling headaches along with an odd metallic taste. Jason had to assume that he was being permanently damaged and shoved Cage along to get through the tunnel and into the building as quickly as possible. He didn't think he was going to make it and was struggling to keep his thoughts coherent while his feet plodded along automatically. Jason was in such a daze that by the time Crusher wrenched open the flimsy gate that was probably more to keep vermin out than intruders, he had to be pulled into the basement of the building. Cage led them quickly through a short corridor, and then, once he slammed the shielded door closed, the effects of the radiated energy began to dissipate immediately. The code slicer had them both lay on the floor and went about reactivating their implants.
I will counteract the effects of the radiation. Stand by.
Everyone okay? Cage asked.
Let's never do that again, Crusher groaned, and rolled into a sitting position. Captain?
I'm good, Jason said,
as Kaz used the implant to control the emergency medical nanobots in his body to erase the headache and disorientation. He pulled the power pack for his weapon, then the spare. Both were showing errors.
Damn, these didn't make it.
So we have no standoff weapons? Crusher asked.
Nope, Jason said.
Lead the way, Cage. Let's do this as quick as possible.
What the hell sort of power are they using here? Crusher rubbed at his head. There's no way that's not going to have permanent side effects.
Theoretically, the damage is non-cumulative, but I would definitely have Doc check you over once we're back on the ship, Cage said. We need to go one floor up, and then you two will get the fun of overpowering a manned security station before we can get to a direct access node.
As it turned out, Cage's information was incorrect, and there was nothing more substantial than a flimsy door with a mechanical lock to keep them out of the access point. Showing his disappointment, Crusher pulled one of his blades and wedged it into the door frame, the molecular edge easily slicing down through the locking mechanism without making it too obvious someone had been tampering. While Jason moved to check all the other points of entry, Crusher posted up by the door they came in through while Cage broke out his equipment and began connecting into the station's systems. Since they'd come in on the backside of the hardware firewalls that protected access points near the docks and hangars, it didn't take him long to force his way into where he needed to be. By the time Jason returned, he'd already uploaded the search parameters from the images they'd pulled off the Phoenix and had the computers churning through the data for matches. Almost immediately, partial hits began popping up, and Cage had to reset his search filters to chop out anything under an 80% certainty, as they didn't have the time to comb through false positives.
We have enough 90-plus hits that I'd say this guy was definitely here, Cage said. Starting an analysis of movements over the time period most of these images were captured. With any luck, I'll have his daily routine down and we can snag him at a shop while grabbing his morning tea.
I wonder if there'd be a decent market here for coffee, Jason mused, causing Crusher to roll his eyes.
We have a problem, Cage said. Nope, we have two problems. Which one do you want to hear first?
The most immediate, Jason said.
Your buddies from Tenix 6 are here, and by here, I mean they're already on the station and coming towards the operations center, Cage said. Public security camera picked them up getting into a ground car on the hangar level.
How did you manage to just randomly find that? Crusher asked suspiciously.
With all this computing power available, I put up an alert if any small ships docked with or landed in the station, Cage said. I sort of expected this. I assumed they'd put a tracker on the Phoenix before we left Knot. Our ship is just as recognizable as theirs.
Shit, Jason muttered. What's the other bad news?
Our target isn't on Taurus Station anymore. He left about half a year ago. I've got him getting on a commercial transport, and that's the last entry for him. I'm doing a data dump now for the Starliner docking orders and passenger manifests for that time. We'll need to analyze it on the Phoenix because someone is aware I'm snooping around and I'm getting some pushback.
After the data dump, purge the station servers of anything you found on the target, Jason said. Don't leave anything for Jurg and his band of ass clowns.
Are those clowns that...
It's just an expression. Don't overthink it, Jason cut off Crusher.
Data's copied. Images of the target are purged, Cage said. You ready for bad news number three?
Why not?
The purge action kicked off an automated anti-intrusion protocol. I didn't see it because it was dormant, and honestly, they seemed pretty lax about security and I was moving fast. We'll have trouble getting transportation out of here, and we'll damn sure have trouble trying to get through dock security and back onto the ship.
Tell Doc to disconnect and move away, Jason sighed. We'll find another way out of here.
That doesn't sound promising, Crusher grumbled. Come on, we need to get to where we stash the party favors before any security or mercs show up.
The trio rushed out of the room and ran smack into a security patrol that had been walking slowly towards them, apparently intent on seeing what the alarm in an obscure network access closet was about. When a wild-eyed galvanic warrior leaped out in front of them, brandishing two wickedly curved blades, whatever training they may have had for their job was promptly forgotten. Crusher roared and lunged at them, a tactic that was met with partial success. One turned and fled as if his life depended on it. The other fainted and collapsed into a heap where he stood.
You are so easily entertained,
Jason stepped over the prone alien while Crusher giggled and followed behind him. They made it to the side exit without further incident other than hearing calls over the PA to clear the area where they were. Everything seemed to be smooth sailing right up until Jason kicked the door open and ran out into the open just as two members of Chenix 6 had apparently been affixing a breaching charge. He'd hit the door with enough force to send one sailing, but the other stayed on his feet, and he was the one holding the detonator.
"Move!"
Jason shouted, angling away and accelerating to clear the way for his friends. The three of them were down off the wide steps and sprinting towards where they'd stashed their gear just a split second ahead of the detonator button being depressed. The blast was mild, just a shaped charge that was meant to cut through the locks and hinges as quietly as possible, but it did still manage to kick the door back into the face of the alien Jason had knocked down. Apparently, it not being seated into the frame made it somewhat unpredictable once explosives were applied.
"Ha! Nice shot, ass clown!"
Crusher shouted from behind the dubious cover of the discarded work containers and the laser boring machine. Jason looked up and saw that the door had probably killed the first alien. Jurg was really going to be pissed now, and the sapper that had been a bit trigger-happy was now fumbling for a weapon, looking incensed at Crusher's insult. Before the alien could pull his concealed weapon, Crusher lined up with a plasma pistol and hit him center mass from a range of nearly 60 meters, an extremely impressive shot with that weapon. Jason pulled fresh power packs for the railgun, squeezed off a low-velocity test shot, and then waved for his friends to follow him down a side alley and over before the rest of the Chenix 6 could make it around the operations center to see what had happened to one of their entry crews.
"Cage, I need a way out of here," he shouted over his shoulder.
"This station is equipped with over 200 Class 4 escape pods. If you were to utilize one, it could be flown away and retrieved by the Phoenix."
"Not bad," Jason muttered.
"Cage, find the closest escape pods."
"What the hell good does that do? You're not going to blow up Taurus Station, are you?"
"No. Well, probably not. The pods are Class 4. We can actually fly them away for a distance," Jason said, pulling up when it was obvious they weren't being pursued.
"Huh,"
Cage grunted.
"That's actually another good idea. There's a cluster half a click that way."
They slowed to a brisk walk, not wanting to attract undue attention, now that they could hear alarms blaring in the distance around the operations center they'd just made a mess of. As it turned out, three heavily armed aliens in a nice part of the government district drew attention whether they were running or crawling, so they took off again as fast as they could.
"Keep cover! The security for these pods is automated."
Cage popped off an access cover and let a few silvery tendrils of nanobots flow from his palm into one of the connectors to give him a hard circuit into the machine.
"How the hell did Chenix find us so fast, even with the tracker on the ship?"
Crusher asked, when they scanned the surrounding areas.
"That makes no sense. Cage spots them as they hit the hangar level and they made a direct line for us?"
"Unlikely that it's pure coincidence," Jason agreed.
"Could the smuggler they captured have given them that much detailed intel before we got to him? You know, the one you blew up?"
"I like how we keep dragging out all my mistakes over and over," Crusher said sourly. "It's possible the guy who sold the confet shuttle knew that he was heading here first."
"It's also plausible that the operations center would be the logical place to go if you were going to..."
"Aw, damn,"
Jason trailed off. That wasn't a multi-pronged assault. That was only two guys sent to get the information Jurg wanted. They were using breaching charges because they're morons and have one mode, but that makes far more sense than our blind escape evading one of the better hit teams in the quadrant.
"If what you're saying is true, then we probably should have questioned the live one," Cage said. "They may have had a few more clues we were missing."
"Thanks," Jason said dryly.
"What's taking so long?"
As if that was the magic passphrase, the security gate popped and then slid aside with a slight squeal from its unoiled rails.
"Nothing,"
Cage smiled.
"After you."
Jason and Crusher stepped into the staging area, while Cage relocked the gate and then gestured for them to take the path furthest to the right.
"There's a long transfer tube you'll slide down that has some gravassist to keep you moving once you drop past the main gravimetric generators."
Jason just nodded and hopped into the tube with his feet together and his weapon held against his chest. The asteroid that Torres Station was built into was, more or less, an enormous chunk of nickel iron. There were enough impurities in it that it wasn't worth the cost to mine it for anything useful. But there were enough people enamored with living inside hollowed-out asteroids that the local government was still able to lease it out. Since the asteroid was small and hollowed out in such a way that the levels were stacked like a building, artificial gravity had to be employed to keep everything anchored down. The chutes to the escape pods passed through nearly 70 meters of solid iron and put them on the bottom side of the station's grav generators, so low-powered grav plating had to be added along the way. Jason didn't mind it so much except for the jerk it gave him every time he passed over one.
"This isn't a very efficient system for escape pods," Jason commented, once they were all standing down in a dimly lit vestibule right outside the main airlock hatch.
"More for show than anything else," Cage said. "Having all these advanced pods in place helps when selling property here and keeps the local inspectors at bay. In reality, having to travel 5 minutes to the pod during a catastrophic station failure means you'll probably die like everyone else."
"All the more reason to get the hell out of here," Crusher said, and cycled the airlock. The pod blew free of its moorings and launched them out free of the asteroid. Cage disabled the tracking beacon, and then hooked into the limited comm system so that he could try to raise the Phoenix.
"You know, that seemed way easier than usual," Crusher said with a yawn.
The other two just looked at him like he was insane for tempting fate in such a flagrant way.
"There's the pod," Twingo pointed out.
"I have it," Doc smacked the engineer's hands away. "Just tell me where, don't actually point on the display. The ship should be able to recognize the standard airlock on the front of that thing and adjust her orientation automatically."
"Did you also see that there's a ship that left the station's main hangar and is moving on a direct intercept for the pod?"
Twingo asked. Doc looked at the sensor feed and scrunched his nose up.
"Station security?"
"Not in a ship like that," Twingo said. "Hang on." "Yep, the profile has been changed, but that's Jurg's ship. They must have followed us out. Cage mentioned Jason thinks they put a tracker on her."
"No, they're going straight for the pod," Doc said. "They're bypassing us like they don't see us."
"That's not good," Twingo said. "How rusty are you, Doc?"
"Why?"
"We're going to full combat mode, powering up weapons, shields, and warming up expendable munitions. Is Lucky still sitting on the floor in the galley?"
"Last I saw," Doc confirmed.
But he flew through his checklists to bring the Phoenix up to full power.
"You better get in the co-pilot seat. I'll need a hand with this."
"You never did answer my question."
"I don't think you want to know the answer," Doc said grimly.
Chapter 19.
"It looks like Jurg is going for a grapple," Twingo said. "That gives us a little more time than if he just fired off a fusion missile at the pod."
"How do you want to handle this?" Doc asked for the third time. He had calmed down some and seemed to be finding his rhythm again with the Phoenix, though all he'd done so far was maneuver so that he had a clear shot without endangering the pod.
"No warning calls, no warning shots," Twingo said. "I doubt we'll disable him at this range with anything less than an XD missile, and all that we'll do is bring that Confed trawler in for a closer look before we can get the crew out of the pod and mesh out. Line up for a lateral run with the main cannons. The plasma bolts aren't very fast, but Jurg isn't a great pilot, so we probably can't juke out of the way in time."
"At this range?"
"At this range, scaring him off is just as good as destroying him, maybe more so," Twingo said calmly. "I know the plasma bolts lose cohesion as the field emitters lose charge, but it should still be enough to knock the hell out of them. A few energy blasts splashing off shields won't bring anyone out to investigate. An expanding cloud of debris will."
Doc grumbled, but took Twingo's advice, accelerating hard to get ahead of the seemingly oblivious Merc ship. Jurg's craft was an infiltrator, not a gunfighter, so the Phoenix had an obvious advantage. But both of them knew appearances could be deceiving. He pulled almost parallel with the fleeing pod and then swung about as hard as the ship would let him, knowing that Jurg would see them coming after the abrupt maneuver.
"Release helm control to the tactical computer and let it line your shot up," Twingo said. "There you go. Almost. Clear to fire." Doc squeezed and held the trigger. The six main cannons along the leading edges of the wing roots began belching brilliant red bolts of superheated plasma while the computer adjusted fire by angling the ship over slightly. The plasma cannons were a devastating weapon, but severely range-limited. By the time the first bolts splashed against the transport shields, they'd lost much of their destructive energy. But they made a hell of a light show. The ship was engulfed in streaming zero-G flames as the shields flared to absorb the thermal shock. The results were immediate. Jurg yanked his ship off course to take him directly away from the approaching gunship, even while Doc reversed his angle to turn into the fleeing transport. Doc squeezed off a few more shots to try and really sell the illusion that he was pursuing with an intent to destroy, before throttling back and bumping into reverse a bit to slow their relative velocity.
"He's out of here," Twingo said. "Sensors show they're at full burn still, and accelerating."
"He gave up fairly easy," Doc said.
"That's because he knows he can find us again at will and bide his time until he has the advantage," Twingo said. "The guys were right. There's a tracker on this ship somewhere."
"How close was he?"
"Less than 3,000 kilometers," Twingo said. "He was definitely trying to capture you."
"Damn," Jason said, rubbing his jaw. "This is weird. Good job chasing him off, but we need to find that tracker and Prano." They decided the best place to hide was in plain sight while Chenix 6 was still able to track them, and the Taurus Station security was whipped into a frenzy. Jason put the Phoenix back into formation, the same one with two con-fed ships, and then watched the sensors as Twingo and Cage scoured the ship for the tracker. It wasn't an easy job since the device was made to not be found, and it required more than a few EVA excursions out onto the hull. They even had Jason deploy the landing gear while they were outside to check it over. After 38 hours of exhaustive work, they'd still found nothing. They were all frustrated and tired, and tempers were wearing thin. The Phoenix was still floating in formation, now directly behind the Confed trawler, so close that Jason could just make out the bluish flare from the drives. He knew he wasn't the most technically savvy of the bunch, but he was a born problem solver. If, after damn near 2 days, they still hadn't found the tracker on the Phoenix, then logic dictated that it likely wasn't there. In an epiphany born of exhaustion and caffeine, he realized that the clue wasn't that Jurg kept finding them, but that he seemed to know specifically where Jason was. He'd been coming directly at him once they'd launched in the escape pod.
"Kaz, what are the chances that Jurg stuck a tracker in me while they had me chained to the chair?" Jason said when he was alone. "Wouldn't you have noticed that?"
"Not necessarily. As I have tried to explain, I exist as a fragment within your neural implant. I am not fully integrated into your systems, and while you are unconscious or asleep, I am quite unaware of the world around us. I also cannot detect tactile sensations, so if something was surgically implanted while you were unconscious, I would have certainly missed that."
"Interesting," Jason said, ignoring the sarcasm. Kaz would sometimes seem all-knowing, so it was easy to forget just how limited the accidental intelligence really was.
"What's interesting?" Doc asked, walking onto the bridge.
"It's interesting that you walked onto the bridge at the exact moment I was about to ask that you give me your most invasive, nastiest, intimate examination of your life." Jason smiled widely.
"You know what? I put up with a lot of... I'm actually being serious, Doc," Jason said, holding up his hands in surrender. "I think the tracker we're looking for may have been put in me when Jurg had me captive."
"That would make more sense than it being on the Phoenix, now that I'm thinking about it," Doc mused.
"It'd have to be something that's able to transmit in slipspace, but this stuff is getting smaller and smarter all the time."
"And we can assume that Jurg has access to all the latest and greatest as one of the assassins many governments will turn to first when they need someone offed," Jason said.
"We'd better get started," Doc said. "We can't just sit here behind this confed ship forever."
"Please come in and sit, Alucard. I thank you for coming."
"Sadita Vamok?"
Hallocker said, with a half-smile. Or, should I call you, you would be wise to refer to me by the name I have given you, Mach said coldly.
Of course, Hallocker said smoothly. I must admit to being surprised by this invitation. I would assume the situation in the Empire consumes your full attention.
The Empire will have to handle its affairs without my help, I'm afraid, Mach said. The Confed struck with such speed and precision that there's not much to be done from my former homeland at this point, and certainly not by someone like me.
You may be surprised.
Yes, Mach said slowly, staring at his guest with an intensity that would have wilted most. So I've asked you here because at the request of a mutual acquaintance, I've been making discreet inquiries into your background. Imagine my surprise when I learned you're not actually with Keprian Intelligence anymore.
No more than you're still with Eshquerian Intelligence, Mach, Hallocker said. I'm still a patriot, and I'm still doing my duty, just as you do, in your own twisted way.
Fair point, if somewhat inaccurate, Mach shrugged. So, who do you work for? Why are you running around tracking retired fleet officers while simultaneously dabbling in highly illegal battle synth research programs? Hallocker seemed to size Mach up before answering.
The rumors of your affinity for this Merc crew I've hired have a little more truth to them than I would have thought, he finally said. Let me assure you that I am not using Omega Force as cannon fodder. I legitimately hired them because, despite outward appearances, they're probably some of the best in the quadrant at what they do. If that will assuage your fears some, perhaps we can discuss the details of why finding this officer is so important. One mighty empire has already fallen, and these are just the opening moves, my friend. I promise you it won't be the last. If my suspicions about you are true, then you could be a powerful ally in the days to come.
And if your suspicions are false?
Then I'll likely be dead before I make it back to my ship.
Over the course of the rest of the day, Hallocker laid out the Quadrant's current political landscape from a perspective that Mach didn't have. Much of it he already knew, but the parts he didn't added context that didn't paint a pretty picture for the future of freedom-loving species everywhere. By the time Hallocker wrapped up his presentation, Mach was feeling the first twinges of real fear at what the regime change within the Confed could mean. I can't commit much at this point, Mach said. Despite rumors and appearances, I'm still subject to the will of the leadership within this organization. If I make moves that are too radical or not profit-oriented enough for their tastes, then they will waste no time in replacing me. I don't do anybody any good dead, especially not me.
Understood, Hallocker said. I still appreciate you listening to what I've said, and any help with transportation and locations for manufacturing would be more helpful at this point than direct aid that can be traced back to you.
Agreed, Mach stood, indicating the meeting was at an end. Be careful, Hallocker. You're only one crew. Pick your battles wisely.
Hallocker just smiled and nodded before walking out of the office. Once he was gone, Mach entered his credentials into a secure terminal and began going through a detailed listing of his organization's assets. He started with the big ones, planets, moons, orbital facilities, and ships. It was an impressive list, but in light of what he'd just learned, it might not be enough.
Chapter 20
Impressive bit of tech, Cage said.
He was holding a specimen container that held a state-of-the-art slipspace position tracker, still covered in human blood from the extraction.
It's not as small as I'd assumed, given that none of our normal scanners picked it up, Jason said, rubbing his right buttock where the device had been embedded.
It's actively shielded, and when it detects scan fields, it goes dark. Cage said.
How did you not notice the incision scar? Crusher asked. They didn't do a great job patching you back up.
How often do you turn around and stare at your own ass in the mirror? Jason asked. You know what? Don't answer that.
So, do we just incinerate it or have a little fun first? Twingo asked. We have three of those slipspace decoys from the Ust-Jono mission in the cargo hold, unless you two sold them for booze money.
What do they look like? Crusher asked.
About 2 meters long, sort of a flattened cylinder with a sensor bulb at the front, Cage said.
Doesn't ring a bell. They should still be there, Jason said, pulling up his pants and trying to maneuver around everyone crammed into the infirmary.
Go set one up and send Jurg on a merry chase while we figure out where we're going next.
So,
Cage said, after he and Jason were alone in the comm room.
So?
There was something interesting knocking around in your neural implant during that procedure. I was monitoring its output while Doc was probing around in your backside.
Cage's seemingly casual interest raised alarm bells in Jason's head.
Just the usual crap that you've put in there, he said.
And we're not using the word probed anymore after that parasite issue on your call 4, remember?
Don't remind me, Cage shuddered. But back to the subject at hand. There was something else.
The computer alert cut him off, and a new list of cross-reference data popped up on a fresh display.
Got him!
Really?
Yep. We were able to bounce his image across multiple databases on the station to get his compartment number for the Starliner he rode out of here on, the destination, and the name he used, Cage said.
Venda Say, Jason read off the screen. Fairly generic Verbin name. So now we have a species, too.
Any way you can check to see if he's still on Thalia Prime?
Not through this many Nexus nodes if we want to keep this discreet. It had flagged for sure if anyone had part of that data and was also looking for him, Cage said. We'll either need to get closer to the source or kick this up to someone like Mach or Alucard.
I think we'll do both, Jason said after a moment. After Twingo sends his decoy, we'll begin heading towards the Thalia system. I want you to compose a message to both Mach and Alucard and tell them what we have so far and see if there's any additional intel we need before arrival.
Jason left quickly before Cage could complain or change the subject again. He knew what the shifty little code slicer must have detected within his implant, and he wasn't ready to divulge that information just yet. Partially because he wasn't sure what he was going to do about Kaz, but mostly because it would force him to admit that he'd been carrying around the combined knowledge of an extinct superspecies in his head for years, and he hadn't used it to make them rich. As that's how those conversations tended to go. An hour after they had a new destination in mind, the decoy was ready to be heaved out the back of the cargo hold where it could trail behind the Phoenix for a bit, before zipping off on its own mission. Cage and Doc had pulled another half a liter of blood from Jason so that the tracker would still be in sufficient biomass that it wouldn't alert the owner that it had been removed. Or Jason had fallen for another cruel joke at his expense. Either way, there he was, light-headed and woozy, tossing the decoy off the back ramp and through the electrostatic barrier.
I appreciate the honest assessment, Kalea, Celadus Dalton said, passing a hand over her face.
She'd summoned her favorite task force commander in to get her opinion on the Confed move against the Ashquarian Empire. The news wasn't good.
I wish I had better news, Kalea said. But at our current strength, and even taking into account a possible alliance with the Protectorate, we just don't have enough warships to hold against the Confed fleet if they come against us. Even with the humans churning out their new Defender-class destroyers at an impressive rate, it would be too little, too late. Crafty little creatures, those humans, Celadus said. I'm curious how, in the span of 10 cycles, they're fielding more advanced starships than we have access to through some of the best commercial yards in the quadrant.
I have suspicions, Kalea said flatly. Celadus looked at her appraisingly, but said nothing more on the matter. She was well aware of the failed relationship between her admiral and a human that, despite his many qualities, had managed to get her father executed by a foreign government. She knew the whole story, of course, but it didn't help her settle her feelings on the matter. Her muted rage was directed more at the arrogant Avarians than it was at Jason Burke himself,
The man had a right to defend himself, though she felt he could have been a bit more even-handed about the matter. Even now, she still thought her father had been acting in the best interests of all, despite the evidence that he'd participated in the kidnapping of the Avarian sovereign's daughter.
"So, what do you suggest we do, Admiral?" she asked.
"This is far outside my area of expertise or comfort, Chancellor," Kalea said. "Tactics I can do, long-term strategy between nations is something I actively avoid." "You know my father had been grooming you for just that, don't you?" Sila Das asked. Kalea said nothing. She was uncomfortable with the tone her boss took when she talked about the relationship the then-captain had with Christoph Dalton.
"I think he knew his offspring might be ill-suited for the job. At least that's how I interpreted it."
"I couldn't speak to your father's motivations in most things, Chancellor," Kalea said carefully.
"Of course not,"
Sila Das smiled humorlessly, before changing subjects again.
"I think it's likely, necessary even, that we'll be forced to bend to the Confed's wishes when they come. Given our small stature and the fact we've been careful not to be seen as competing for the same resources, I'm hopeful that they will just wring unfair economic concessions out of us, but we'll maintain our autonomy. However, please be sure the fleet is ready for any action required of it."
"I will, Chancellor," Kalea said. She would normally answer that question with a perfunctory, "of course," but that response seemed to enrage her boss of late. The last time she'd uttered it, Sila Das dressed her down in front of the other flag officers about the dangers of assuming she knew what the Chancellor wanted.
"You may go, Admiral."
Kalea swiftly left the office, collecting her aide in the outer lobby as she did. Sila Das was becoming increasingly unpredictable the more the pressure mounted from the changes within the Confed. She waffled from being the hopeful, benevolent leader she was when the cooperative was founded, to being angry and bitter that her father's death had left the mess in her lap. One thing the Admiral didn't doubt: the wolves were at the door. Things had been happening within the Confed, and, against her advice, Sila Das had withdrawn much of their presence within their own borders. The consolidation, as she called it, left them vulnerable and made them appear weak. They had no intelligence apparatus to speak of, most of their information coming from an increasingly bold Earth military that was sending out scout ships faster than any other colonizing species. The problem with the human intel was that their data lacked a lot of context, and it was sometimes difficult to gauge the true severity of a threat from their reports. What she needed was a reliable, close perspective of the recent troubles. She would normally reach out to Jason, even given how things had ended between them. But the last she'd heard, he and Crusher had gone on a rage-fueled warpath along the frontier after Lucky had been killed on Kepri. She'd watched him during similar bouts of self-destructiveness, and she knew that much of what she'd get from him would be useless if he was living on anger and alcohol. Hells, he probably wasn't even aware that the Ashquarian Empire had fallen with little more than a whimper. Maybe she could try to use back channels and reach out to one of his friends within Earth's new military. If nothing else, they'd likely been tracking Confed fleet movements. For all their faults, humans seemed to have a knack for espionage and fighting, and being stubborn Zephorns that couldn't admit when they were wrong.
"Just received word back from Mach," Cage announced. "Weirdly enough, his people and Alakers worked together to get this intel."
"So what's the good word?" Jason asked.
"Chenix-6 might have been the least of our problems," Cage said. "Word is that a Confed strike team is on its way, too. They must have figured out who and where this Venda guy was through other means."
"An actual strike team or one of those hit squads from Intel Section?" Crusher asked.
"I'm reading it how it was sent," Cage said. "Mach said strike team."
"That's not good," Jason said. "We're way undermanned to be taking on a pack of those psychopaths. Any chance either of them can send help now that we have a good location for this guy?"
"Mach is sending the closest crew he's got, but they won't get there until well after we do. Alloker has no resources available. His unhelpful addition was to tell us that any risk we took to grab Venda would be worth it, Cage said.
Worth it for him, Twingo muttered. He's got no skin in the game.
We'll have to hit hard and fast, and that means having an accurate, detailed layout of the planet's orbital control system, defenses, and average military or law enforcement response time. Jason looked squarely at Cage as he said this.
Point taken, Cage said. But that last time was a fluke, you have to admit. I'm usually spot on when it comes to threat assessments.
No comment, Jason muttered. Anything else? Am I to plan the ground op, assuming that our friend here won't be joining us? Crusher asked, nodding towards the battle synth that was now staring at the simulated starfield on the main canopy, but not interacting with any of them. Jason couldn't tell if it was an improvement or not. Kaz kept telling him to remain patient and hopeful. Jason was neither.
You would assume correctly, he said sadly. We'll be there in 4 days, and he's not showing any real level of improvement or that he even understands what's happening around him.
You called him he instead of it, Doc said quietly. That's at least some sort of improvement right there.
Jason looked over at his friend, but said nothing. He just rolled his eyes and walked off the bridge. Chapter 21 Minister Sklees paused outside the chamber where the Master, a title he was certain the being hadn't picked for itself, held audience. He'd been summoned and cleared through security, but there had still been someone in there and he didn't want to intrude. Unable to help himself, he listened in to what was being said. He recognized the voice of Starfleet's head of operations, the person who was the direct intermediary between the Confed's civilian government and its military arm. The second person in there sounded familiar, but Sklees couldn't place where he'd heard the voice.
Only take the Solas 7 days to get there if we issue movement orders now. The strike team is already days ahead and will reach the planet shortly.
Excellent, the Master said. The redundancy of both forces will ensure that the traitor is not given the chance to slip from our grasp again.
My forces need no redundancy.
Now Sklees knew the voice. She was the director of special operations. Her office was under the umbrella of Intel Sector to keep the budgets opaque. But her resources were more often at the disposal of Starfleet, as Intel Sector had their own operators that were a bit more restrained for their type of work.
This is no time for territorial squabbles, the Master chided. Too often in the past, objectives have not been met because of ego and artificial boundaries. You are allies, not competitors. No matter whose forces execute the traitor, it is our victory. Now, please, go about your tasks, and allow me to speak to the minister who is waiting outside.
Sklees stood impassively as the two filed past him with little more than a curious look, before he went into the chamber and waited. When he'd first been summoned and the disembodied voice began issuing him directives, he'd laughed at the melodrama and absurdity of the whole thing, right up until the newcomer showed him the video proof it had of his own indiscretions. He knew, at that moment, he'd do anything he was told to keep his offspring from learning of his less charitable attributes.
This isn't like you, skulking about in the corridor.
Yes, I know you were cleared by security, the Master said. I wanted you to hear what you did.
So, we found our missing fleet captain? Sklees asked.
We did. He's on Thalia Prime.
Never heard of it, Sklees admitted.
It's not a significant world, and it doesn't fall within your sphere of influence. He's been living under the name Venda Say. I've sent a strike team to handle him, and should they fail, there's a contingency plan that will eliminate any chance of him escaping.
I heard. The Solas is a battleship. Is that not a bit excessive?
Considering the rate of failure when it comes to finding this wayward officer, I'm inclined to excess this time around, the Master said,
with what almost sounded like a chuckle. Our intelligence service managed to backtrack him when he made a mistake and reached out to someone in his old life. Someone we had under observation. Sometimes all it takes is just one tiny mistake, and the whole thing comes undone. Isn't that so?
I suppose it is, Master.
Was there something specific you needed from me? The Thalia operation may have some unintended consequences. Political consequences, the Master said. Your job will be to make those go away with minimal disruption. This cannot be allowed to delay our schedule.
What sort of consequences? Sklees asked, dreading what the answer might be.
Civilian casualties are a distinct possibility, depending on who Vendase has enlisted to aid him.
Then perhaps it would be wise to hold off.
No! The Master thundered, its voice distorting under the volume. This man must die, and I will not pass the opportunity given to us. He was there with me at the beginning, and then betrayed me. I will not allow that to go unpunished.
As you wish, Sklees said, his voice trembling. I will make preparations at once.
Without waiting for a dismissal, he fled the chamber before he completely lost control of himself from fear. It seemed that the Confed's new dictator, emperor, had severe impulse control issues. All this time, Sklees thought they were pursuing a renegade fleet officer because he held state secrets that couldn't be allowed to leak out. Killing one military officer for the greater good wouldn't make him lose much sleep. But now, it looked like the new boss was willing to kill civilians over what amounted to a personal grudge from being rejected. It didn't even look like the captain was much of a threat at this point. If he hadn't spilled any secrets he'd known by now, it would seem that he was content to live out the rest of his life in secret.
Damn that idiot for breaking cover, Sklees fumed, referring to Vendase. If he'd just stayed underground, nobody would have ever found him.
Sir? What?
Oh, nothing, he said to his ever-present assistant. I need you to do me a favor. I need a face-to-face meeting with someone named Sadita Van Mok. Do it as discreetly as if your life depended on nobody finding out, because it does.
Not the Sadita Van Mok. The assistant was appropriately scandalized at the mere thought of a senior councilman requesting a meeting with one of the Quadrant's most notorious crime kingpins.
Yes, Sklees said, that one.
The contact information is in my personal files. He'll have to jump through some hoops, but he'll eventually answer. When he does, come directly to me.
May I ask what this is regarding?
Correcting the biggest mistake of my life.
Sir?
Just some business, my young friend, Sklees said, speaking up. It's nothing to be concerned about.
How's it going, Lucky?
Jason found the battle synth standing in the cargo bay by itself and figured he'd try one more time to get through to it.
Guess I owe you an apology. I haven't been very helpful while you've been going through something that has to be traumatic as hell.
He hopped up on a stack of crates that the battle synth had been standing near. The hold was jammed full of crap at the moment, and Jason couldn't remember when they'd taken on so much cargo. At least it was all secured down with netting and locked to the deck.
It's been tough on me. Nothing like what you're going through, I assure you. And I guess the reason I haven't been as open towards you is I'm scared you might not really be in there. For humans, hope can be a cruel and soul-crushing thing. It pushes us to accomplish great feats, but when hope isn't realized, the fall can be more demoralizing than anything. When you grabbed that bomb on Kepri and told your brothers to drag me out of there, losing you was one of the hardest things I've gone through. I hadn't gotten over it, but I'd accepted it. Then I come home and find out that those two idiots found your brain still intact in what used to be your original body, and that they were going to try and put you in a new one.
No matter what Tallis or Alucard told me about tempering expectations, I let myself hope again. I guess some part of me thought you'd hop up off that table, give some straight-laced remark about everyone crying, and we'd just go back to the way things were. The battle synth was now staring at him intently, even leaning in a bit now, studying him. Jason could see its eyes roving around his face as he talked.
Crusher wasn't much better. We'd all been through so much together, and honestly, I figured the order we'd die in would be me, Crusher, and then you. There's some wiggle room there, because it's possible that Crusher and I would kill each other and it would be a tie. But I always alleviated my own guilt at your staying by my side with the fact that I'm very mortal and you aren't. Once I kicked off, you'd be free to find your own way again.
He looked up and saw that he still had the machine's rapt attention.
Look, buddy, we're heading into a hot one. We'll be taking on a Confed strike team, and not the pansies from Intel section, a real group of hitters this time. I don't know if all of you is in there pounding against the wall, screaming to be heard, or maybe if it's just a part that carries some memories of your past life. Either way, I could use your help. I have no right to ever ask anything of you again. If you pull through and decide that you want me to fly you to Terra Novus to be with your lot mates, I'll do so immediately. But maybe we all pull together for one final mission as a team.
Jason paused, feeling grubby and ashamed that at the end of spilling his heart out about his lost friend, he had tried to cajole the battle synth into fighting for them. He had no idea why he'd said it. It just came out. Maybe he'd run out of things to say, or maybe he was more afraid of the coming operation than he let on. But he certainly wasn't proud of his actions.
"I've got to get ready," he said, patting the battle synth on the shoulder, roughly, like he used to.
"I'll catch you later."
"Later, Jason."
Jason wheeled and stared at the battle synth, eyes wide, but it had already turned away and was inspecting the lockdowns on the next pile of cargo crates. Had he imagined it? He tried to recapture its attention, but the moment had passed. With a weary sigh, Jason trudged off to the armory to begin prepping his gear. They had 9 hours before they were in the Thalia system, and he hadn't even given much thought as to how he wanted to run the mission. If he didn't push the distraction of Lucky out of his mind, he'd end up getting himself and his friends killed.
Chapter 22.
"What the hell is that?"
"It's prototype armor that Alucard's people made for me while they were bored during Lucky's reintegration," Jason said.
"Supposed to be the latest and greatest in Keprian research."
"So we're calling him Lucky again? Wait, don't change the subject," Crusher said. "If it's such sophisticated armor, why does it look like a shitty pressure suit with some stuff attached to it? What are those bands? Actuators?"
"It's not powered," Jason said. "It looks like a shitty pressure suit because that's what it once was. What part of prototype isn't sinking in? They needed something substantial that also already fit me. This is the suit I normally wear on EVA. They've just modified it."
"That explains the smell."
"So, what's it do?"
"I'll let that be a surprise," Jason said. "For both of us.
It'll either protect me from energy and kinetic weapons better than my older, bulky powered suits, or I'll die when the first shot hits me."
"That'll be interesting to watch either way," Crusher yawned.
"Agreed," Jason said, as he shrugged into the outer layer. The Phoenix was in normal space and about halfway through the system to Thalia Prime, and they were both starting to get the pre-op jitters, so the gallows humor the others found so disgusting was in full swing. He looked over as Cage prepped his own gear, the Viren unable to hide his anxiety behind jokes and bluster like they did. Jason needed to engage him without being coddling or condescending. In truth, Cage's growth in his absence was as impressive as it was unexpected.
"How about you, Cage? Any special toys you're bringing to the party?" he asked.
"I've got more of those little drone bombs, a few wide-area munitions, and Twingo and I modified this light plasma rifle with a narrow focus, so I'll be able to burn through armor without lugging a heavy around,"
Cage said.
Plasma guns are supposed to be wide-area weapons, Crusher said. Why not take one of the captain's real guns if you want something light and precise?
I've never used one, Cage said. I'd rather not start experimenting during a live op.
Sensible, Crusher agreed. Do we know anything new about the objective?
I've tracked his movements on the planet via immigration records, Cage said. He's now a permanent resident of Thalia Prime and still living under the Vendisea alias. We know that he immigrated here with three other beings, ostensibly his family, but there aren't any records of their names.
That's odd, Jason said.
One of the quirks of this planet's bureaucracy, Cage said. Only family heads are counted when a group arrives together and plans to cohabitate.
The house location still concerns me, Jason said. There's no way to get in touch with Venda to try to have him relocate to someplace less populated?
There is, but I still recommend against it, Cage said. This is someone who's been on the run under an assumed identity for years. If we come bumbling in and start asking him to expose himself, we'll likely just send him to ground. I'd imagine this guy has more than a few escape routes already planned.
Jason knew everything they were rehashing, but it helped cement it in everyone's mind, especially Crusher's, and it kept Cage focused on the parts of the mission that he was comfortable with, and off the fact that he'd been forced into an operational role by necessity. Maybe after this mission, assuming they survived, Jason would look at bringing someone else on to fill the void left by Lucky. Since the decision appeared to be unanimous that they wanted to continue with Omega Force for the time being, he'd have no choice but to fill the large gap in their roster.
We're coming up on our orbital insertion, Doc said over the shipwide. Landing control has us 85th, so it'll be another 5 hours or so before we deorbit.
I'm taking a nap if this is going to take so long, Crusher said, stretching out on the bench in front of his wall locker.
Not a bad idea, Jason agreed. I think I'll grab something else to eat first, though. This has all the earmarks of being a long one.
The three of them went their separate ways to spend the last few hours before such a dangerous op how they wished. Jason wanted to spend the time getting his mind right and completely focused on the mission. He'd been so distracted by the situation with the battle synth aboard that he was afraid he was approaching this half-cocked and that all the things he could have overlooked would get him and his friends killed.
You know the drill, Doc, Jason said into the comm. Put her out in a holding pattern away from the city and tell ground control that you're doing a maintenance flight.
Copy. We'll be waiting for your signal.
The Phoenix roared back into the sky after dropping Jason, Crusher, and Cage off near an industrial district. They'd dipped and slowed, using the transit beam to get them and their gear to the ground before the authorities had a chance to ask why a ship was attempting to land in an unauthorized area. They hit the ground hard, as it had been just a little over the maximum altitude the beam would work at. As planned, they'd inserted at night, at a time that the biological workforce in the area would be at a minimum. There were still aliens milling about, largely ignoring them, since commercial delivery vehicles used a similar type of transit beam. But it was a reduced workforce, mostly there to babysit the factory's automated systems.
You like that one?
Cage asked, indicating a generic-looking wheeled vehicle parked near a loading dock.
Yeah, it looks like it won't be missed anytime soon, Jason said. Go ahead and get started and we'll keep watch.
I like that we're starting this mission by stealing someone's vehicle, Crusher said enthusiastically.
I'm not above a little petty thievery to keep in practice, Jason shrugged. This is less risky than trying to pay for one anonymously near a spaceport or renting one. I'm not sure the Confed team will know that they're in a race with us or not, but no point in taking unnecessary risks.
The commercial vehicle was one of the ubiquitous electric drive wheeled types that were on every planet, even those that were wealthy enough to utilize repulsor air cars. This particular one had a large cargo box attached to the frame behind the 6-passenger cab. Cage bypassed its security lockouts with ease, and within minutes was in the driver's seat and rolling towards Jason and Crusher.
You called for a pickup?
Good job,
Crusher said, tossing his gear into the rear cab and climbing in after it.
Let's roll.
The drive from the northern industrial district to the residential area Vendisea's home was located in
would take 4 hours since they were limited by the vehicle's speed and needed to stick to the indirect surface roads. Jason had swapped seats and was driving so that Cage could access the local Nexus and begin gathering intel on their target as they went. From what he had been able to find,